About good ascension apostle. Acts chapter 2 is about spirit kingdom. Acts chapter 3 is about second sermon, and then Peter is then going to be arrested upon his second sermon. So Acts chapter 4, what's Acts chapter 4 about? Peter's defense, he, John, and the crippled man, who's no longer crippled, are arrested. Then we get to Acts chapter 5, and what happens in the beginning of Acts chapter 5? First discipline, that's Ananias and Sapphira, and what were they disciplined for?
Lying to
the Holy Spirit, that's right. And then the end of Acts chapter 5 is second defense, because who is arrested that time? All 12. And what's the irony that happens? They're arrested by the Sadducees. And what do the Sadducees not believe in? Angels or the resurrection. How do they escape from prison? An angel releases them and tells them to go preach the resurrection. So a lot of irony there. Acts chapter 6 is about the seven. Acts chapter 7 is about Stephen's death, or Stephen's defense, whichever you remember it best by. And then we get to Acts chapter 8. Who is the primary evangelist in Acts chapter 8?
Philip.
And the first individual of note in Acts chapter 8 is who? Simon the sorcerer. And then the second is the Ethiopian eunuch. That's right. Then we get to Acts chapter 9, and we meet the primary historical character for the rest of the book of Acts. Acts chapter 9 is about... yeah, Saul or Paul's conversion. And then you get to Acts chapter 10. And Acts chapter 10 is an identical blueprint to what happened in Acts 2, but not with the Jews. So Acts chapter 10 is about Gentile spirit kingdom. Good. Then you get to Acts chapter 11. What happens in Acts chapter 11? Oh, not quite. Because Peter, remember, is with Cornelius, and then he's going to come back and he's going to bring a... report, and then where the first missionary journey is going to start out of, there is a primarily Gentile church that begins. And what church is that?
Antioch.
So it's report Antioch. Then you get to Acts chapter 12. What happens in Acts chapter 12 for the first time? That's right. The first apostolic martyr. James is killed, and then Peter ends up being released from prison by the Lord as well, and escaped, released, however you want to put that. Then you get to Acts chapter 13. What happens in Acts 13? First missionary journey begins. Acts 14, the first missionary journey is completed. Then you get to Acts 15. There was a big argument going on in Acts 15. And there was a sect of the Pharisees that were teaching that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised and keep the whole law. And on that note... they ended up discussing this, and what was the conclusion that the apostles and the elders came to? That's right. They are not to keep the law, but to stay away from idols, to not drink blood, to not eat things that have been strangled, and to, that's right, not be sexually immoral. So you have that decree that's made. Acts chapter 15 is then the Jerusalem conference. Then you get to Acts 16, and what happens in Acts 16? It actually starts at the end of Acts 15. The second missionary journey begins, and he goes all the way up through. He revisits Derbe and Lystra. And by the way, who's from Lystra that Paul picks up there? No, Silas is with him in Antioch. They go together, because remember, Barnabas goes to Cyprus with John Mark. That's right, Timothy. Timothy he picks up in Lystra, and they go up, and they get to, they're trying to go north, but the Spirit doesn't let them, so they have a vision. They start going towards Macedonia. Who do they pick up in Troas? He's a physician. He's the writer. Luke. And so then they end up in Philippi, and that's how that section ends. Then you get to Acts 17, where we finished last week. And what are the three churches that are planted in Acts 17? Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Those and the primary ones, though, are Philippi, Thessalonica and Berea. There's going to not be a lot that is said about Athens after that. All right, now we come to Acts 18, where Paul is going to leave Athens and he's going to go to Corinth. And there is a lot that happens in this chapter, so we are not going to get through all of it. And we're also going to break up the chapter because the second missionary journey ends at verse 22, and then the third missionary journey begins in verse 23, and it goes all the way to chapter 21. So we're going to break this up a little bit, and we aren't going to go so much by chapter like we have before, but we're going to go by journey. So this is the second missionary journey is going to be complete. That's Acts chapter 18, verses 1 through 22. So we start off with a clicker that doesn't work. Man, I'm on point. All right, here we go. So we already mapped this. He started in Antioch, visits Tarsus, goes up here, picks up Timothy. They come all the way up to Troas, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. And then Paul's going to leave Athens, and he's going to go 50 miles southwest to Corinth. And you could have traveled by land by this isthmus that's right there, or you could have traveled by sea through this gulf and then arrived at Cenchrea, which is one of the seaports. Let's talk about Corinth for just a few minutes. He arrives at this city called Corinth. What do we know about Corinth? Anything off the top of your head that comes up in your mind in your study you've done about this city? Okay. Idolatry? Okay. There was the city originally was sacked by Rome in 146 BC, and that's because they were pushing back against Rome, and they leveled the whole thing. Before that happened, there was a temple that was set up to Venus or to Aphrodite there, and there was 1,000 prostitutes that were in that temple that you would, this is how you worshiped the gods. You would go to the temple, you would interact with these prophetesses in a sexually immoral way and thus worship the gods. And so when that was leveled, Julius Caesar would come in 100 years later at around 50 BC, and he would rebuild Corinth to its former glory, and he would rebuild that very temple. And we have no reason to believe, there's lots of historical evidence that the same practice continued in that city. We don't know a number of how many prostitutes were in the temple, but very idolatrous city and very involved in sexual immorality. All right, what else about Corinth? Was it a poor city or was it a rich city? Rich. This was the capital of the Roman province of Achaia. And Corinth was a very rich city. It had two seaports, one to the east and then one to the to this side that opened up to two different seas, the Aegean Sea and then over here. And so everyone that was coming in to Greece would have to go through Corinth. And those ships would actually have to be carried over that isthmus because sailing around the Cape was very dangerous. So as all the slaves were carrying the ships over the isthmus, all of the rich owners and captains would go into the city and they would trade and buy and sell. And so Corinth was a very lucrative place to live. It was the center of commerce, the center of industry in the ancient world. So where Athens was the center of philosophy and education, this was the center of business. And if you think America, you might think, what city? Yeah, New York City. That's what pops into your head. This is what would have popped into their head, is the city of Corinth. So Paul arrives in Corinth, and when he gets there, he finds a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. And Luke explains why they're there, because Claudius, the Roman emperor, had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome, and he went to see them because he was of the same trade and stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. All right, lots to talk about here for just a minute. Let's just get the basic stuff out. So Paul joins in with them for what purpose? What reason?
To teach that Jesus is the Christ.
Okay, that's a possibility. We don't know whether or not they're Christians yet or not. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But what was it that was drawing Paul to them specifically? Yeah, they had the same job. And in that day, there were three different materials that they made tents out of. It was either a linen or it was a leather, but the primary way that they would do it is goat's hair. They would actually take black goat hair and they would weave it to make kind of a cloth, and it was weather resistant or rain resistant. It was very weatherproof, and it was a very lucrative business, actually. Especially if you're in Corinth, you're in a city where people are traveling all the time. They're going to need this kind of travel material as they go about their business, and so. Aquila and Priscilla were probably doing fairly well, just like Lydia, who was a seller of purple. That's what most scholars think. So Paul joins in with them, but here's what's interesting. Are they Christians yet? Yeah, we really don't know. And there's some debate about this, because it would be unusual for a Jew to allow Paul into their home, to live with them and interact with business, with the attitude that most Jews had towards Paul, with Paul being who he was. But the question is, if he was already a Christian, then where did he learn the gospel? Because all that we know is that he comes from Italy. Now, whether he was there because he was a slave, that happened a lot. If you had a skill, then the Romans would send you up and use you in that way. Perhaps he's a freedman, and that's why he's come down. But what's interesting is Luke generally will tell of someone's conversion history if they weren't a Christian already. Remember, Lydia, specific individual, we learn of her conversion and her obedience to the gospel with all her household. And then you see the same thing with the Philippian jailer. And you see the same thing with Cornelius. And specific people that are named, you always see Luke recording their obedience to the gospel. So that might be evidence, because we don't see that here, that they were already Christians. We just don't know. We do know that by the time that they would leave, that they certainly would have been Christians, because they join with Paul, and later on in Acts 19, we know that they're helping to better teach the way of Jesus to someone named Apollos. But the reason, one of the things that someone brings up is, well, he calls him a Jew, so therefore he must not be a disciple, a Christian, or else he would have called him a disciple. Well, it appears that Luke is simply trying to explain why they're in Corinth. Because he was a Jew, and because Claudius has made this edict, that's why he's there, and that's why Paul was able to link up with him. That's the reason why Luke cites, by the way, he's also a Jew. In my opinion, it appears that Aquila and Priscilla were already Christians, but we cannot be certain, and I don't know that for a fact. So don't quote me on that and take it to the bank. That's just my opinion. Now, we've already talked about this edict before. Claudius reigned from 41 to 54 AD as the Roman emperor. And somewhere between 48 to 52, he made this decree that Jews were to be expelled from Roman cities and Roman provinces. And so that's why they left Italy and came down here. And that's why we saw the anti-Semitic attitudes towards the Jews in Philippi. Do you guys remember that? And there's just this attitude that's been cultivated by the Romans towards the Jews. They thought of them as really second-class people, that they were just a bothersome people that stirred up a bunch of trouble. And that was part of the reason for the expulsion. And it surrounds a particular individual, and we're not going to get into all of that because it's extra-biblical material and it's all speculation. But for whatever reason, Claudius has expelled everyone, and we come into this scenario where they're down in Corinth and they hook up with Paul. And so Paul from here, surprise, surprise, he's going to go, where does he always go? The first place he goes into a city. Synagogue. Because Romans 16 says that the gospel's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew and second to the Greek. That's right. So that was Paul's pattern, is it was always the Jews and then the Gentiles. But as has happened before, typically when Paul approaches the Jews, they do what? They reject it. Yeah, Brad. Help.
Some familiarity.
Yeah, yeah. And he needs that because, remember, and we're going to talk about this right now, but when Paul left Athens, Timothy wasn't with him. And neither was Silas. Silas was in, likely, remember, Luke was in Philippi, Timothy was in Thessalonica. Where was Silas likely? Berea, that's right. And so Paul's alone, he comes down, and he needs some familiarity. That's a good observation, because he's by himself at this point. And so he goes into the synagogue, and every Sabbath, he is reasoning with the Jews and the Greeks, and he's trying to persuade them that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ. So during the week, he's working as a tent maker, and then on the Sabbath, he is going in and is trying to persuade them and teach them that Jesus is the Christ. He doesn't have a lot of time because he just has the Sabbath until Silas and Timothy arrive from Macedonia. Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. When it says Paul was occupied with the word, really the idea is then devoted fully to the word. When they came from Macedonia, what did Timothy likely bring to Paul again for him? Yeah, financial support. Now some argue, no, because remember Paul writes to the Corinthians, I didn't take your money. Well, that doesn't change that at all. He didn't take the Corinthians' support, but here he receives support from likely Philippi, as Timothy and Silas come back to him from Macedonia, and now he can devote himself fully to the preaching of the gospel. He's not having to work with his hands. So now, daily, he's trying to convince the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. Yeah, Dave. Good. All right, so Timothy shows up, and it's not just the financial support, but Dave brought this up. He hears how the church is doing in Macedonia. And here we are going to have, everyone put this as a light bulb, we're going to start memorizing these. We're going to have the location and the time in which Paul writes his first epistle. And the first epistle that Paul is going to write at this point is to what church, might you think? Thessalonica. The epistle of 1 Thessalonians is written at this point. And when you look at 1 Thessalonians, go ahead and open up there for just a moment. I don't have it on the PowerPoint. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Chapter 2. No, I was wrong again. Chapter 3. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Paul reminds them of what had happened before. This is when Paul had sent Timothy away from him to go to Thessalonica to check on them while he was in Athens. He says, therefore, when we could bear it no longer, We were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother, and God's co-worker in the gospel of Christ to establish and exhort you in your faith, that no one be moved by these afflictions. And he goes on to talk about the trials that they were going to face. Now jet down to verse 6. But now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love and reported that you always remember us kindly and long to see us as we long to see you, for this reason, in all our distresses and afflictions, we've been comforted about you through your faith. And Paul goes on to write about this. So as soon as Timothy comes back, that's when Paul writes this first epistle. And it is likely going to go back to the Thessalonians by the hands of Timothy. And Paul did not wait that long to then write the second epistle of Thessalonians. So the first one is 1 Thessalonians. This is really hard. The second one is 2 Thessalonians. And most scholars believe, due to the language and the way that Paul writes, that it was no more than a couple of weeks to a couple of months later that Paul would have written the second letter to the Thessalonians. And the reason for that is Paul was writing back to explain some things that they were confused about. In the first epistle, Paul's going to spend a little bit of time talking about working and the return of the Lord. And they had some confusion about that and those that have already fallen asleep in the Lord. And so Paul's going to address those specifically and write immediately back to them while he's in Corinth. So this is the moment when Paul writes 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians. In the meantime, while that's happening, Paul is going to then turn away from the Jews and go on to the Gentiles. Remember in Ezekiel, when Ezekiel talks about the watchman and that the watchman's job is to warn the people, and if he says warning and they don't leave the city and then they're killed, their blood is on their own hands. But if the watchman does not say anything and they come in and destroy the city, then their blood is on his hands. So this is what Paul says, and they would have known the prophets, known this passage and several like it. Paul, after preaching the gospel, and when they opposed and reviled him, and this could be what Paul's referring to when he talks about them saying anathema Christ in 1 Corinthians, what they were saying. And so he goes on and he says they were reviling him, they were opposing him, and he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent, and from now on I will go to the Gentiles." So he's no longer meeting in the synagogue. He's going to go next door to a Roman fellow who was a proselyte at the gate named Titus Justus. And he's not to be confused with Titus of Acts chapter 15. Different spelling, different age group, different city. And most people believe, when you look at this individual, that his first name, his whole name, Romans had three names. And there's some research I did on that. We're not going to get into that because it's not important. But they believed that this was Gaius Titus Justus. And when you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 14, it reads the following. Paul says, "I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius," two individuals from Corinth. So it's a possibility that this individual here, Titus Justus, a worshiper of God, this proselyte, was one that Paul himself baptized. Now this is amazing. It says that his house was next door to the synagogue, so there's this complete shift from the Jews to the Gentiles. And now the proselytes and the Gentiles are now meeting in his home where Paul is teaching and is preaching the gospel. And one of the individuals who leaves the synagogue and comes to sit at the feet of Paul is none other than the leader of the synagogue. And his name was Crispus. Now look at this again. I'm going to read 1 Corinthians 1:14 again. "I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius." Look what two individuals are spoken out by Luke and written by Luke. Crispus and possibly Gaius. same individuals that Paul is writing about in 1 Corinthians 1 as we're reading about right here. This is when it happened. And what's amazing is we've read of Gentile families all believing the gospel. When Cornelius believed, it was he and all his household. When the Philippian jailer believed, it was he and all his household. When Lydia believed, it was she and all her household. This is the first time you see a Jew and all of his Jewish household believe the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not that it didn't happen before. It might have, but this is the first time that it is recorded for us for an entire family of Jews to come to the Lord. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire house, and many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. Now, what a blow this would have been to the Jewish community there, because Titus, it appears, would have been, because he's a Roman citizen, he could have had a lot of influence in that area. We just don't know a lot about him, but that's a possibility. They've lost a proselyte at the gate, a prominent fellow, and they've lost one of the leaders of their synagogues. The Jews are going to have a reason to be angry, aren't they? And in typical Jewish fashion, just like before, when the gospel was preached and people were being converted, what did the Jews try to do to Paul? They always tried to kill him. So if you're Paul and you're seeing this great success, what's the earthly side of you going to be thinking at this point? Here we go again, right? I wonder when I'm going to have to get out of town. And when you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 3, Paul writes to the Corinthians, he says, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. Paul was terrified. And Paul was going to be devoted and committed to the preaching of the gospel, but he knew that his life was at stake again. And so the Lord is going to appear to Paul simply to encourage him. And so in verse 9 we read, the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, do not be afraid. And that's in the continuous imperative. And so what the Lord is saying is, stop being afraid from now on. Stop being afraid. And so that shows us automatically that Paul was afraid. I would be too. And Paul's fearful for his life. But the Lord says, go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people. So a couple of things. He says, don't be quiet, and the only reason Paul would be quiet is in fear for his life. So the Lord confirms him and says, you keep speaking because I'm going to make sure that no one attacks you to harm you. Now, did the Lord say, no one will attempt to attack or harm you? No, but he says, no one will be successful in doing so. We're going to have this great moment of irony in just a few moments when the Jews try to silence Paul and harm him, and in doing so, they are silenced and then beaten in trying to do the very thing to Paul. It actually happens to them. But there's another thing to notice here, too. The Lord says, I have many in this city who are my people. There's an expression, there's power in numbers. How many times do you read in the scriptures, so-and-so didn't do something or did do, or you know, didn't do such and such in fear of the people or in fear of the multitudes or in fear of the masses? There's power in numbers. And if more people are converting to the gospel of Jesus Christ, that they're now outnumbering the Jews, is that going to be a smart move for the Jews to take action against the leader of this movement within the city? It's just like the advice that Gamaliel gave, remember, to the rest of the Pharisees and the rest of the Sanhedrin and said, you need to leave this guy alone. There's power in numbers. And so Paul ends up staying a year and 6 months preaching and teaching the Word of God. Almost, you know, that's a long period of time. He stays in Ephesus 3 years on his third journey. But this is a significant amount of time that Paul is staying to teach, to preach. And it's not just to convert people to Christ. Remember the Great Commission? The first part is preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit. But the second part is teaching them to observe all I have commanded you. Just for the exact reason there was someone left at every church that he had planted, Paul now stays here and is helping to root and ground the Christians by teaching them to observe all Jesus commanded. Brad. Yes, I believe that that's also a correct understanding, that this might not even be referring to those that were already Christians, but the Lord sees the hearts of men and knows the gospel is going to thrive within this city. And so he's trying to encourage Paul to say, continue to speak, you are going to be received, you are going to see fruit, you are going to see people obey the gospel. So that's another thing to think of there as well. So Paul stays there for a year and a half, and then the Jews start doing their Jew stuff again. So verse 12, but when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, all right, before we go on there, when we talk about Gallio, Gallio was the brother of Seneca, and he was a famous historian and writer and philosopher to the Romans. And in his writings, he talks a little bit about his brother Gallio, who was actually from Spain. And he writes, no mortal is so pleasant to any one person as he is to everybody. Now, that's a lot coming from someone's brother to write about their brother, that he's the nicest person I've ever met. But Gallio had this reputation of just being a very gentle, very kind spirit, which was unlike a lot of Roman rulers at that time. He was actually, his real name was Marcus Annius Novatus, but he took the name Gallio from his adopted father. So he's a Spaniard, but now he is a Roman ruler. And the Jews know he's got a soft spot, and so they're going to seek for an opportunity to finally get rid of Paul. So we don't know if there was something that has happened. We don't know if there, like, a specific incident that finally pushed them over the edge, or whether it was just time, but they get together and they make a united attack on Paul, and they bring him before the tribunal saying, this man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law. Now, what law are they referring to? Roman law or Mosaic law? Yes, right? We've at this point dealt with people making claims that it is dealing with the Roman law, because they know the Roman law. If they're teaching something new, then that is not a religion that can be practiced, and so therefore they would be condemned, and so that's how they're going to trap them. But because of Gallio's response here, it appears that their complaint had to do with the law of Moses. That because he is teaching things about worshiping God that they believe were contrary to our law, that we've got a problem and you've got to do something about this. And the whole reason they would do this is because, Reese talks about this, on certain days each week, there was a court session that was held in the marketplace and people were allowed to bring their problems before the officials. And when you would do that, this was called a curel, and it was just a raised platform, and I don't have a picture, but apparently you can still see this very curel that they would have brought Paul upon in Corinth still there today. It's still sitting there. And this is where they would have made judgments about different grievances or different problems that people had. So here's one of those opportunities. They see, we're gonna bring Paul before the tribunal. He's going to get rid of Paul because he's messing up with our religion. Well, this is how Gallio responds. Paul doesn't even have time to defend himself. Gallio's going to do it for him. And so he says to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crimes, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. So in other words, we're not dealing with domestic violence. We're not dealing with someone that's a thief. We're not dealing with any of these other legal, state issues or domestic issues. But here Gallio explains how he at least understood their complaint as dealing with the law of Moses. He says, but since it's a matter of questions about words and names, and your own law, see to it yourself. I refuse to be a judge of these things. Now, Gallio, when he, remember, Jews were considered second-class citizens. What was the trump card? Roman law or Mosaic law? Yeah, Roman law. They didn't care about Mosaic law. They didn't care what the prophets said. They didn't care what any of these things said. So in his mind, you're arguing about names. I don't, Jesus or Messiah, that's your business. I am not a judge over your law. So if you want to judge him, then you need to see to it by the way that you judge your own law for your own selves. Don't bring him here up to me. You're wasting my time, is basically what he tells the Jews. Brad.
Mm-hmm. And Gallio saw right through it. No, that's just your law. It's not a Roman law issue. Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely a possibility. There's no reason to. We can't claim it is for certain or that it isn't for certain. But that would certainly fit the bill if that was the case. He could have saw right through their plea if they were trying to make it about Roman law, but really this is about their own. So here's where things get a little interesting. It says, and he drove them from the tribunal, and they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. And Gallio paid no attention to any of this. Now, we have some questions we have to ask. Who is they, and who is Sosthenes? Well, and so maybe he ruled with Crispus. Or maybe he's the replacement since he is now a Christian and has likely stepped down from that position in the synagogue. But it's a Jew that's beat. So who the they is going to explain who Sosthenes is. Now, one interpretation is they is the Jews. And that the Jews turn around and beat their own ruler to the synagogue. And the reason this is put into thought is there is a companion of Paul named Sosthenes in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. And so a lot of people believe this is the same guy. Well, Sosthenes was a very common name. So we don't know that for a fact. But the explanation behind that is they say, well, Sosthenes didn't really give it his best shot because he was starting to believe in the gospel, and so that's why they beat him. And then later he became a Christian, so we see him in 1 Corinthians 1. So that's one possibility. We're going to get the second one in just a second. Go ahead. All right, good. There is a manuscript. We're going to talk about that. There's a manuscript difference. In some of the earlier uncials, they don't have the Greeks, but some of the later manuscripts and a lot of the minuscules, they do have that excerpt there, the Greeks. So the King James, and I believe the New King James, has the Greeks seized them. It doesn't have that. It just has a neutral they in the Greek in the earliest manuscripts that we have. So that's the reason the New American Standard and the ESV and others translate it not the Greeks, because they're based off the earliest manuscripts. But I believe that the later manuscripts, even if it wasn't in the earliest ones, a lot of times what happened, and I don't want to get into a discussion about scribes and what they do, but a lot of times the reason things change from the original is because they understood what it was saying and would, quote, make it better. They would correct it. And so they understood that it was the Greeks, and so they just wrote that in there. And then it was copied from then on, the Greeks. That makes the most sense, actually, because it says that he drove them out from the tribunal, and that's Gallio. Now, if you're going to drive someone out, how do you do that? By force. When you drive someone out, you're not like, all right, move along, let's go, guys. You know, you're driving someone out, it's by force. It appears that this ruler of the synagogue didn't want to go yet. And so those that were in charge of the court, those that were watching over Gallio, beat him in front of everyone and publicly humiliated him. So look at the irony of what's taking place here. Maybe he's the brains behind this, Sosthenes, all the Jews, they get together, they make this united attack to silence Paul and to beat him. And then Gallio turns around and he silences the Jews, and the ruler of the synagogue is beaten. This is the first time you see this go this way. Every other time it's gone against Paul. Here, the Lord, what he promised, comes true. He says, no one's going to harm you. And in fact, it was the Jews that ended up getting beaten because of this. Yeah, Brad. That's right.
Keep on.
That's right. Dave, did you have something?
Yeah, with that too, I like the fact when you look at the Apostle Paul, he has the very same feelings and things that we would deal with as we do today. He was afraid. Mm-hmm. That's why the Lord had to come to him in a vision and tell him, don't be afraid. And so the realness of Paul, if we get to see that side of him, he deals with things just as we would. He sees all the corruption. He sees what happens. He's blaspheming. You know, they're opposing him. He feels the fear. He knows what's happened previously, and he's afraid. Mm-hmm. But the Lord comforts him, and so he keeps going forward. And like Brett said, I can see God's hand in that, protecting him and making sure that no harm comes to him, because he's got to be there a year and 6 months, mm-hmm. and he's got to be rightly teaching all these people.
Yeah.
God's
going to
make sure that it's planned. Right?
Yeah. Well, Paul's also going to be wise, and at this point, after this happens, Paul's going to say, time to move along. And so we won't have time, we're out of time today to finish the second missionary journey, these last four verses, so we will do that next week. But Paul stays many days longer, so he's safe, he doesn't rush right out, but he does go ahead and exit after this instance, and they're going to go with Priscilla and Aquila. His end goal is Antioch. They're going to end up hitting Cenchrea, which is where Phoebe is from. And it's likely that that's where she was very helpful to him in the gospel when Paul writes about that. They're going to come to Ephesus. Paul's going to do an in and out there, promise to come back, and he will, and he'll stay for 3 years on the third missionary journey. And then Paul's going to go down to Caesarea, to Jerusalem. We're going to talk about that. And then back up to Antioch, where he'll complete his second journey and then start his third thereafter. All right, thank you so much.